I've called this talk The Unenlightened Englishman, and I'll explain a little bit more why I've given it that title. It's about Sangharakshita. I'll say a few words in introduction though before I explain why I've given it that title. I thought we would do the Metta-Bhavana meditation, the loving-kindness meditation. And there is a reason for that. In a way, it sort of epitomises for me a contribution that Sangharakshita has made to modern Buddhism, which specifically is raising the profile of the Metta-Bhavana meditation, and more generally is bringing in very, very traditional and very crucial aspects of Buddhism, sometimes giving them a new and different emphasis. So the Metta-Bhavana meditation is a meditation that the Buddha very strongly encouraged during his early teachings, and is always there. You'll find it in all Buddhist traditions. But it's something that Sangharakshita decided to give equal emphasis to mindfulness meditation, which isn't always the case in other Buddhist traditions. Now, I'm not sure why he decided to do that, but I think it may well go along with the fact that he felt that the cultivation of your emotions is as important as the cultivation of your understanding, as your mindfulness and sensitivity and all that kind of thing. And so he felt that as well as doing the, as it were, inward-looking mindfulness of breathing, it's very important that people who are trying to practice Buddhism also do the outward-looking love and kindness meditations and are taking their emotions seriously and cultivating positive emotion in that way. Now, the title of this talk, The Unenlightened Englishman, it refers to a film, a documentary, a sympathetic documentary about Sangharakshita that was made in the late 80s by a filmmaker called Bob Mullins. It was shown on Anglia TV, and it was called The Enlightened Englishman. Now, naturally, Sangharakshita wasn't very pleased with that title because he's not enlightened. But it's a nice film, and there are interviews with him, and it also follows him on a return visit to India, where he'd spent so many formative years as a Buddhist monk, as he tours the holy places and gives lectures to the to Buddhists in India. And it's to India that Sangharakshita was fortuitously sent as a soldier during the Second World War. So, Sangharakshita is unenlightened. Probably most of us here are also unenlightened. And I do think that one of the interesting things with a prominent Buddhist teacher is that people do tend to swing too far one way or the other, either, as in the case of the title of that film, overestimating them, sticking them up on a pedestal. Here's this wonderful person, only, of course, to be knocked off when you realise that they have feet of clay and they're not perfect by any means. Or, on the other hand, underestimating them and thinking that they're just completely sort of ordinary. Underestimating them as a human being and also underestimating their achievements. So I hope I can give a relatively balanced picture of Sangharakshita. I'll say something about his life, what he actually got up to, and his reason for wanting to found a new Buddhist movement, and a little bit about the approaches he's taken, the teachings that he's made, as an introduction to a series that we'll do. And I hope the series won't be just out of interest in the guy who founded the Sri Ratna Buddhist community. I hope it'll also be useful dharma, because I think there is a lot of very useful dharma there, bringing in traditional Buddhist teachings, but also slants on those teachings which reflect modern society, Western culture, and so on. So I talked about Sangharakshita arriving in India with the army, with the Royal Signals, in the 1940s, but he was actually already a Buddhist at that stage. It wasn't going to India that made him a Buddhist. So he was a Londoner, of working class origin. He was born in Stockwell, brought up in Tooting. His father was a French polisher. His mother was of Hungarian refugee stock. And what happened to make him a Buddhist was this. He was a bookworm as a teenager. At the age of 16, he was wandering down the Charing Cross Road, went into a bookshop, picked up a book. And this book was the Diamond Sutra. A very important and very extraordinary and almost completely incomprehensible Buddhist text, the Diamond Sutra. You may have had a look at it. I mean, it is wonderful. And I can remember a sort of a parallel experience, although actually long after I got interested in Buddhism, I was working at the Open University, and a volume of Perfection of Wisdom Sutras came in, and it was there. I would always look at the new acquisitions every week, see what new books they got in. And I read this, and it's as if sometimes you pick up something, and on the one hand, you cannot work out what it's about, but on the other hand, you feel there's something absolutely amazingly profound, something that transcends the possibility of the rational mind to take in, which is coming through these words. And that's what I felt with that, and I think that's what he felt, or perhaps even more, when he read the Diamond Sutra at the age of 16. And he sort of resonated with it. And what he said later on about it, he said, when he read it, he said, I knew I was a Buddhist, and I had always been a Buddhist. So it wasn't a conversion experience, it was a recognition experience, which is very interesting, isn't it? And in the 75 years since then, that deep experience and all its implications have been working through him and, you know, have given a direction to his life, I suppose. So with that initial contact with Buddhism, I'm not going to say more about his early life there. There's a lot one could say. He's written huge volumes of autobiography. But when he was posted to India with the Royal Signals, he was delighted. He thought, great, right. And they went to Sri Lanka, they went to Singapore. So he had a chance to encounter Buddhism in the East. And when the war was over, he didn't wait to be demobbed and sent back to England. He just burnt his passport and wandered on the dusty tracks of India without possessions in the footsteps of the Buddhist monks of old, with just one companion, dressed in just a piece of cloth that he dyed using alum and a particular soil that you get in there, again in the traditional Buddhist manner, and with no money, no vehicles, nothing at all, just relying on what people would give them, and living as a wandering ascetic. And then later on he was ordained as a bhikkhu, a monk. He was ordained by a Burmese monk, which made him officially a Theravadin Buddhist, member of the Southern School. And then he found a Theravadin teacher, an Indian monk, who taught him Pali, and who sent him to a town in the Himalayan foothills called Kalimpong, and said, go there and work for the good of Buddhism. And he lived there for 14 years, practicing, did a lot of meditation, and meeting refugee Mahayana Buddhist teachers, mainly from Tibet. And these teachers became his gurus. So this picture here shows eight particularly important teachers. This was the Theravadin monk who taught him Pali, Jagdish Kashyap. And this was a Chinese Zen, or Chan, teacher called Yogi Chen. And then the other six are all Tibetan lamas, Tibetan teachers. And in fact, I've just noticed on the back, it even says who they are, if you're interested. So actually, it wasn't that he started off as a Theravadin, by the way. The very first article he wrote for publication, he was 19 years old, and he wrote an article for a journal called The Middle Way, which was on the unity of Buddhism. And it was something that he felt very strongly from the beginning, that, you know, where you didn't have to be a sectarian if you're a Buddhist. You didn't have to decide on one particular national-based tradition to follow. In a way, there was a huge amount of riches in this vast Asian Buddhist tradition, coming from all sorts of different places, and there was no need for you to sort of reject some and accept others. And of course, so it was fantastic when he met these Mahayana teachers coming down from, most of them Tibetan refugees, but fantastic teachers, people who had an enormous influence on him. And so he was writing, he was teaching Buddhism, running a little Buddhist monastery there. And then after 20 years in India, in 1964, he visited England, and he decided that the West needed Buddhism too. And Buddhism was in a very rudimentary form in Europe and America in those days. So he decided he was going to found a Buddhist order, neither monastic nor lay. One of the things that he'd felt strongly in the East, particularly in the Theravadin countries, was that there was a bit of an issue of the monks being seen as the full-time Buddhists who were simply supported by those who weren't monks. And he felt very strongly, although he was a monk, he felt very strongly that anybody can practice Buddhism, anybody can sincerely devote themselves, commit themselves to practicing Buddhism, and that the lifestyle you follow is an expression of that commitment. And for some people, it'll be appropriate to not to have a family, not to have possessions, to wander as a monk. But for others, it was not necessarily the most appropriate thing. So he wanted to found an order that welcomed both. And that's what is now the Triratna Buddhist Order. And it was founded, as I say, the first ordinations were in 1968. So nearly 50 years ago, that's how long the order's been going. And I'm not actually sure how many people it's got in it now. It's about 2,500, I think, isn't it? Who are actually ordained Buddhists all over the world. Anyway, going back to the 1960s, late 1960s, hippie London, and he flipped away from this austere Kalimpong life as a scholar monk, and much to the horror of the British Buddhist establishment, he grew his hair long, he consorted with the alternative set. And after years of celibacy, he discovered drugs, he discovered music, he discovered sex, he wrote experimental poems, he slept under the stars at Glastonbury, you know, so he really sort of lived the life, even though he was by now in his 40s. So he wasn't a young hippie. And his Buddhist movement attracted a dynamic set of young men and women. Men and women, very interesting also, another reason that he broke with tradition in founding a new order. He wanted something which offered an equal ordination for men and women, which largely avoided the anguish of the traditional Theravadin discrimination against women. Okay, now, late 60s, I was studying physics down at Sussex University in the mid-70s, and that's where I encountered Triratna. I encountered the excellent meditation teaching. I think Triratna is still known generally as being a very good place to come and learn meditation, I hope so at least. And that's what I needed at the time. And I decided, encountering Buddhism in this way, that I was not going to approach Buddhism in my usual academic way of sort of absorbing as much information as I possibly could, because I had this ability to absorb a lot of information as a science undergraduate. But I decided not to do that, which maybe was a shame, because, of course, the founder, Sangharakshita, was a literary man, and he was communicating a lot through his writings, through his books. But what I did do, I didn't listen to read his books, but I did listen to his lectures on tape. And in particular, there was a series called Higher Evolution, which I listened to. And this was uniting science and Buddhism in one great sort of visionary sequencing, which I hope to talk a bit more about in a future talk in this series. And that had a very big impact on me. I'd always assumed that religion and science were opposed to each other. And I'd assumed that I would never be a religious person. I don't think I am a religious person, actually. But, you know, I'd assumed that I wouldn't sort of get committed to anything like that. But then I thought, no, at least in his presentation, and at that time I was a complete beginner, so I didn't know whether he was right or wrong. In his presentation, here was a way of looking at Buddhism as being something which was very much compatible with science, even extending science, even offering a scientific, more empirical way of understanding human consciousness, a personal experience, realizing that personal experience wasn't something which could had to be seen in a completely separate light to the way we understand the universe around us and the evolution of animals and so on. And a year later, after I'd listened to those lectures, Sangharakshita himself came down to Brighton and gave a series, a short series of talks. It was in the King William IV room in the Royal Pavilion, which is this amazing room with hand-painted wallpaper with all these birds and little Chinese trees and things. It's worth a visit if you're ever down there. And so this was, it was popular, they were popular talks, and they were interesting. And I remember he, so he's now in his 50s, he's a guy, still got the long hair, sideburns, and this big mala of huge wooden beads. And just quite sort of scruffy, actually. Quite a scruffy sort of guy, you know. And sort of quite affable, but no, I didn't get sort of, wow, my guru, wonderful. It wasn't nothing like that at all, you know. I just thought, yeah, very interesting stuff. You must go and think about that a bit, you know. Again, which suited me. I didn't want to be seduced by some cult. And in fact, I remember the editor of the newsletter for Triratna in those days once described Sangharakshita as defiantly uncharismatic. which is very, very true, actually, I think. I think. And again, I felt quite grateful for that. I think there's a lot of difficulty with charismatic people. It can be quite a problem. I'm sure for some people, maybe he was charismatic. If you've got any questions and thoughts about all this, do store them up, by the way. I'm going to try and leave plenty of time for that at the end. And another interesting thing was, I didn't really like him. I don't mean I disliked him. It's not so much that, but I didn't particularly like him personally. And it meant that I could just straightforwardly listen to his teachings on Buddhism and evaluate them and decide whether they were useful or not. And so again, I'm quite grateful that in my case it was like that. Anyway, after another couple of years, I moved to Padmaloka. And I decided I wanted to live in a Buddhist community. And I tried one, an urban one in London. And although it was a very, very nice community, I'd been brought up in London and I'd escaped down to the South Downs and I didn't want to go back to London. I really didn't. I loved living in the countryside. So when I discovered that the gardens in this rural retreat centre were horribly overgrown, I went up and talked to the people living there and I said, "You need a gardener here, don't you?" I said, "Will you support me if I come up and become your gardener?" I didn't really know very much about that. I sort of pretended I did. And they took me on. Yeah, so I moved up there and joined the community there. And by this stage, I'd become a mitra. In other words, I'd decided... I hadn't really done the kind of thing that maybe a rational person should do, is try... I like Buddhism, let's try every different kind of Buddhism. I hadn't really done that, I'm afraid, until later. I did actually really explore other forms of Buddhism much more thoroughly, but I just liked... this particular approach. I liked its Western character, I liked its scientific character, I liked its sort of non-religious character, I suppose. And I thought, yeah, I'm just going to stay with this for a while, see how it goes. So I lived in the community up there, and that was where Sangharakshita at the time was living. So for 5 years I lived in this fairly large retreat centre community with Sangharakshita, and I'm really glad about that. That was a fantastic opportunity. Not only was it a great place to live, and it's there that I got ordained and all that kind of thing and learnt a lot about Buddhism, but also I was able to sort of keep an eye on him and see what he got up to and see what kind of a chap he was. I was able to observe him closely. Now this was a phase that he was going through. This was his promiscuous phase, which much later caused a lot of scandal and a lot of problem for him. Now at the time, as far as I could tell, nobody seemed bothered by it. It was still a time when people saw sex as being fun. And I wasn't bothered by it, and I wasn't involved with him. But by then, his lovers were always men. And later, some people who'd had liaisons with him really regretted it, and they felt quite bitter towards him, I think, for, as they saw, using their respect for him as a teacher to get them into bed. You know, that's the way they saw it in the end. And he seems, in retrospect, to have behaved quite callously, I think, towards some people in those days, just seeing sex as fun, a take-it-or-leave-it aspect of what was more important to him, which was friendship, which was connection. Not comprehending, maybe because of all his time out of Europe, in India, not comprehending that for people it was a big deal. There was a lot of guilt attached to sex, especially in connection with homosexuality in their minds. And he has apologised for that phase, but still not everybody is satisfied about that. But that was the time when I was there. I was there, I saw it all. And my dominant experience of him was of a very kind and a very mindful man. Those two things were the main things I noticed, apart from his immense knowledge of Buddhism, and also, not just of Buddhism actually, of Western culture, particularly literature, of Hinduism, very knowledgeable about Hinduism and other religions, very, very interested in culture in general. Very creative also in his thinking, a very unusual mind. And particularly, the most important thing, I suppose, that he really was interested in was how you can practice Buddhism today without losing the spirit of Buddhism. And it's quite a line to draw, isn't it? You know, there have been many modern, as it were, masters who have taken bits out of Eastern religion and tried to form their own version of it, whether it's Krishnamurti or Gurdjieff or lots and lots of them through the 20th century in Europe. And then there are others maybe who've just tried to be very, very traditional, to come from one particular school of Buddhism and to try to keep that faithfully alive and to get a middle way between that thing of doing something that is just your personal approach on the one hand, and doing something that is simply slavishly following a particular Eastern type of Buddhism is a very fine line to draw. And I don't know whether he's always been successful in it, but I think I'm very glad that he attempted that and has attempted that and has encouraged other people to attempt it as well. He's not sort of set up something which is fixed. It's something which is evolving, which is changing, which is being contributed to by other people. So how to practice Buddhism today without losing his spirit? Losing its spirit. And one of the things I remember that he said was that what his sort of credo, in a way, his faith was human beings can change, number one. And this is a very important point, which not everybody would agree with, but in a way you can, you're not stuck. And then secondly, you can change yourself. In other words, it's not you just wait for change to happen. You can actually engage with your life. You can engage with your own mind, your own mental states, and you can do something with yourself. You can, and obviously meditation is important there, but many other practices as well. And then the third thing he said is that you can help other people to change. So you can't make other people change. They've got to do it. But you can be involved in other people in the way that rather than getting in their way as they change, you can actually, you know, be providing conditions, providing encouragement and support that will help them to do that. And then the fourth thing in that little aphorism was, together, you can change the world. So a person can change, they can change themselves, they can help others to change, and together they can change the world. Because if we're going to change the world, if we're going to make the world a better place, improve society, it's a very, very unusual person who can make much of an impact on their own. You've got to be doing it with others, but with others who are committed to their own development, not just with others who have a vision for how the world should be better without them changing. You've got to have that balance, again, between the two. So you're neither sort of an introspective navel gazer, just interested in themselves, nor are you the old-fashioned socialist who knows what's best for everybody else, but yet is very unpleasant to his or her own partner and children and dog and so on, you know. So the two things that I noticed when I lived with him were his qualities of mindfulness and of kindness. And I found that to observe somebody who was seemed to be always mindful was a real lesson, to somehow see that mirror, to see it's possible for a person to be always mindful, and this is what it looks like. I mean, I don't mean that I wanted to imitate his way of moving or his way of speaking or something, but just the sense that, yes, okay, that's what it involves. It's something that needs to become a habit, mindfulness, so that when you sit down to eat, you sit down mindfully. When you start to eat, you eat mindfully. If something comes up that gets in the way of your mindfulness, like, you know, a lot of chit-chat around the table, you may say, I don't think I'm going to join in, you know, with this, all this chit-chat around the table at the moment, because I'm just not able to eat mindfully. I'll join in once I've finished eating. You know, that was one of his habits. You know, he would just eat silently, and then there would be a lot of really fascinating conversation around the table after we'd finished eating, sort of thing. And so on. So mindfulness. But the other side was kindness as well. And he'd have a lot of visitors during this period, ranging from the odd bishop and other Buddhist dignitaries, his Parsi friends from India, people, just, you know, his own disciples, just people from the village, even politicians. All sorts of people would come and see him, journalists sometimes doing interviews. And the interesting thing that I noticed with that was that he was always very good at finding something in common with the person he was talking to. And that's a fantastic skill. It's partly because his knowledge was so encyclopedic that, you know, if what they were keen on was fishing or something, you'd just discover he knew about fishing. And he'd be able to talk to them about that, you know. So he was just very, very open and kind. I did really find him a very warm, very kind person, even though some people, you know, were a bit in awe of him, a bit scared of him. So, I think I'm not going to say much more about the rest of his life from then was to do with setting up Tree Ratna. And actually, one thing I will mention is that I remember when he was about 60, he started very seriously preparing for his own death, which is interesting because he's lived another 30 years or more. But he had been a real invalid as a child, as you may know. He was bedridden for several years as a child, and he didn't think he would live very long. And he decided that one of the most important things is, if you're going to set up a new movement, is it going to survive? And probably the great majority of new religious movements don't survive the death of their own founder, at least not very long. Or, even worse, they turn sour, they go wrong. So he was very keen to make sure that it was something that wasn't just his project. It was something where there were many other people who were involved, who were responsible, who were moving it on. And in particular, from a Buddhist point of view, the important thing here is who is conferring the ordinations. So he decided he wouldn't just form a Buddhist society, but he would form an order. In other words, he would form a Buddhist organization, which at the center of which were people who'd made a full ritual lifelong commitment to practicing Buddhism, which is what ordination means in Buddhism. Next week, we're going to hear from Garsha Devi on Going for Refuge. And Going for Refuge is this traditional Buddhist term which Sangharakshita has really emphasized. You're a Buddhist not because you call yourself a Buddhist or because you look like a Buddhist. You're a Buddhist because the three jewels, the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha, are at the center of your life. So he wanted to say, to have a public recognition of that, a ceremony where people had accepted the three jewels into the center of their life and had been accepted into a particular order. And this is the way that, in their own way, all Buddhist organizations, all Buddhist, traditional Buddhist organizations work. You have an ordination, which in some cases is an ordination as a monk or a nun, but not in all cases, and not in the case of Tree Ratna. So he set this order up. And so you can see, if you think about it a bit, you can see that what preserves the integrity of an order is who is qualified to confer ordinations. Because those are the people who are the future of the order. The people who are getting ordained every year are the people who will be the most important people in the order in 5, 10, 15 years' time. So what he tried to do was to train people up, get quite a number of men and women who were sufficiently aware, sufficiently kind, sufficiently knowledgeable, sufficiently altruistic, I suppose you could say, to be able to confer ordinations. And he started doing that in the late 1980s, so quite a long time ago. So now, in a way, the order can function completely, and could have functioned for the last 30 years without him without his involvement at all. Which doesn't mean, you might think, oh, thank goodness for that, he'd just retire. And I think maybe occasionally he's tried to do that, hasn't he? Sometimes he's just tried, oh, I think I'll just relax and write poems and things, you know, because he loves writing poems. But sooner or later he gets interested in something, new ideas come, and he says, why don't we do this, why don't we do that? And so he gets back involved again, much to some people's disgust. They say, why don't you go away, you know, let the new generation. But he's no longer even the head of the order. He's the founder of the order, of course, but he's not the head of the order. He's not doing any ordinations these days. He's just living out his retirement and writing things. You know, basically, that's the main thing he's doing these days. Living out at Adistana in Herefordshire. And this is, I think I mentioned before, that's a picture of him there in the Malvern Hills. Very nice place. Where you can go on retreat if you want to. And I go on, you know, every so often I go and see him and have a chat and try and catch up with him and keep that connection. Because although I said, it's interesting, I said I didn't like him. I said he was defiantly uncharismatic. But yet, on the other hand, he's extremely dear to me, I must say. He's been a very important figure. I've got nothing but gratitude for him. I know that's not true with everybody. I mean, some people have had difficult contacts with him, but I'm not. He's always been extremely kind and helpful to me, and the approach that he's taken to Buddhism has made all the difference to my life and my practice. So I'm really grateful for that. I've had to do it myself, and I've had many other teachers and who I'm also in touch with, but you know, he in a way is the most crucial one from my point of view, and I really do admire what he's done. And I hope that some of the things that he's done, some of the teachings that he's suggested, some of the things he's put in place will come out in the rest of this series. And I'm going to finish just by mentioning a few of those things. Akasha Devi had a brilliant idea, I thought, for how we could structure a series looking at the life and teachings of Sangharakshita, and that was to use this book, which is called The Essential Sangharakshita. He's written so much, it's just a bit daunting. He's one of those people that is very fluent with the pen, sometimes a little bit too fluent with the pen. You know. And so how do you decide what to read? Well, if you want to really take it seriously, this is a great place to start. It's very well selected and a very broad range of material, ranging from very scholarly material about Buddhism to very poetic material and very practical teachings as well. And so Akasha Devi suggested using the sort of chapter headings in here as our basic structure, and that's what we're going to do. This is a very long book, although you can read it bit by bit, but it's 730 pages long. If you want something a little bit less daunting, I suggest this one, which is also sort of a compilation book, which is called A Guide to the Buddhist Path by Sangharakshita, a very good introduction to Buddhism, but I'm sure even if you know a lot about Buddhism, you'll find a lot that's very useful in that one. But if you look in our bookshop and in the library, you'll see he's produced a lot of stuff to read. And there's a lot of stuff on listening to his lectures. Like, that's the way I got into him. Rather than reading stuff, I just wanted not to sort of take things in a too rational way, but to listen to his lectures is a very good thing to do. And if you go to Free Buddhist Audio, look down, see some titles that strike you as interesting and try listening to his material. So yes, next week we're going to look at going for refuge. Why is it that going for refuge makes you a Buddhist? A very interesting example there of where he's pulled something absolutely central out of Buddhism. All Buddhist schools agree, I go for refuge the Buddha, I go for refuge the Dharma, I go for refuge the Sangha. That is what makes you a Buddhist. But yet he's really emphasised that in a vivid and very helpful way, I think. And Akasha Devi will talk about that next week. The following week, we're going to have Bodhi Leela, who's going to, I think she's going to talk about ritual, isn't she?
I think so.
Yes.
Ritual and probably do something a little bit ritual.
Yeah, I think that'd be good. And I think it's something, we probably know, obviously, Triratna as a place to learn meditation. We also know of all these Buddhist teachings, trying to understand Buddhism. But again, one thing that he's always emphasised is Buddhism isn't just a rational thing, it's emotional. How do you waken up the emotions? A collective chanting and ritual and so on is a really excellent way of doing that. Not for absolutely everybody, it's not that it's compulsory, but for a lot of people it's a really fantastic practice. and maybe a little bit sort of neglected, you know. So we'll have a look at that. I hope we'll have a look at some other topics as well, which I'll mention. The path to enlightenment, the stages of the path to enlightenment. You know, a person can change, they can change themselves. Well, what is that process of change? Okay, we'll understand the stages of it. I want to say something about this evolutionary vision, which is very unfashionable at the moment. It's something that he was really used to stress in the late 60s. And I'd like to revive that, that connection between Buddhism and what is nowadays called the evolutionary vision. I don't just mean evolution in a Dawkins sense of animals. I mean the whole sense that reality is process, and it's law-governed process. It's where you can understand the way things develop, the way one situation can emerge out of another, and how it's possible to make those emerging situations actually progressive, in the sense that you can help a situation to be better than the previous situation. So I'll say something more about that in the talk in 2 or 3 weeks' time. Maybe something on Tri Ratna and the different schools of Buddhism. I think that would be very interesting to look at that. What's it drawn from the different schools? Is it a pick and mix thing? Is it just where, you know, he or other people just gone around saying, oh, I like that bit of Zen, and you know, this is the Kesa, that's from Zen, or oh, I like that little thing from, let's do the Metta Bhavana from the Theravadin tradition, or let's do some ritual from the Tibetans, that's nice. Or is there some deeper principle behind that selective process? Because I think pick and mix according to preferences is not a good way of setting up a movement. And you can see that's why some people have said, let's just stick to an Eastern Buddhist tradition, because I don't feel confident enough to be able to make a reasonable selection from Buddhism that is really true to its spirit and that isn't missing something out because of my own blind spots. And I think this is one of the interesting characteristics of Sangharakshita, is his self-confidence, even arrogance. When I was living up at Padmaloka, I managed to persuade my dad to come up and meet him. And he said, he's quite egotistical, isn't he? And I thought, at first I was a bit, oh, no, it's not. But I thought, yeah, it's true, actually, he is quite egotistical. And that egotism was partly a sense of he felt confident in his own ability to really recognise what was valuable in Buddhism. And I'm really pleased he had that confidence. I don't know if it was always well-placed or not. I'm not really in a position to say whether it was well-placed or not. As far as I can tell, that confidence probably was, on the whole, well-founded. But it's interesting he had that confidence, and I think for some people that's quite off-putting. He felt that he was a significant figure. He was somebody who really could make a difference. On the other hand, I should say, he also said quite explicitly, and he said it more than once, he was not a suitable person to start a new Buddhist movement. And the deficiencies and blind spots in his own personality, like the sexual scandals I mentioned, they definitely got in the way of what he was able to do. And he felt that somebody with a different personality would probably be much more appropriate. But, you know, according to him, he felt there didn't seem to be anyone else to do it. So I just did it, did my best, you know, and he had to discover, he had to learn a lot through doing it. He did it in a very non-systematic way. He did it in a very experimental and even intuitive way. So a lot of the ways that this movement has turned out were never planned. They happened, not necessarily even from him, that other people had ideas. Oh, let's start living together in a Buddhist community. Let's try whether we could found a Buddhist business and work together in that way. What about having a nice big urban Buddhist centre? So all these things came. A lot of them weren't his idea, but he would sort of maybe give them some encouragement and so on, you know. Anyway, that's interesting. Yeah, so Tri Ratna, and how you make a new Buddhist movement, how do you do that? Grounded in tradition, but drawing from the other schools, but also being innovative. And then one or two of the ways that he's looked at things, which I'd say are traditionally Buddhist, but are using Western language. So, for example, what he calls the creative mind and the reactive mind. He's drawn things, a lot of things, from Western psychology like that, the idea of creativity and reactivity in the mind, and a very, very useful way of looking at one's own mental states, I think. So I'm hoping we're going to have a session on the creative and reactive mind, maybe a session on wrong view, right view and perfect vision, a session on the greater mandala of aesthetic appreciation, the importance of uselessness, the importance of seeing things in an artistic way, in an aesthetic way, and not just in a way of what you can get out of things. So that greater mandala is a very interesting teaching, I think. Some Buddhist myths and the way he's interpreted myths, very Jungian-influenced interpretation that he's used when he's looked at the myths of Buddhism. Very, very creative, I would say. Yes, the rituals and ceremonies. Finding emotional equivalence to your understanding. That's an interesting one. I've mentioned how much he's pushed the importance of emotion. And it's not enough. You can understand Buddhism, you can think of yourself as a Buddhist, but it may make no difference unless your heart is in it, unless you really care about it. So how do you find those emotional equivalents to the things that you've understood? Renunciation and desire. The funny thing is, although he was playing around having an active sex life for a period, not for the whole of his life, he was always encouraging celibacy. He was saying, if you feel ready for it, give up sex. It's really complicated, it causes loads of problems. Be like a monk. He always said it's really good to be like a monk or a nun, actually. But he said, but you don't have to. You know, it has to be something that emerges naturally. So looking at desire and renunciation, I think, would be interesting. Gifts from Tibetan teachers. I mentioned most of these teachers are Tibetan. And in a way, we've got a rich pantheon of all those mythical figures from Tibetan Buddhism. The five Buddhas of the Mandala, for example, all the Bodhisattvas, Avalokiteshvara and Vajrapani and so on. I think it's very interesting. Maybe we'll have a chance to look at those. All from the Buddhist tradition, but all sort of brought to life in the West. Everything is alive. Buddhism and nature. Animism. He said that he feels that for Buddhism to really thrive in the West, it needs to have a pagan base. It needs to welcome and celebrate paganism. That is, the sense that nature is alive, that nature is almost has a mind of its own and is worth respecting in that way. And he feels that without that, Buddhism will not become established in the West, without that respect for the landscape and the nature. Kalyanamitrata, gurus, friends, how does that all work? Kalyanamitrata means spiritual friendship. And those are all in the area of Buddhism and the heart. And then Buddhism and the world, I hope we'll have a look at some of that. How much do you need to withdraw into your own practice? How much can you be involved in society and the world? Work and the ideal society. Can you actually start to set up, at least in miniature, a society that works better than ours, a society that is not based on competition between people, on seeking the greatest financial rewards, on seeking status and so on, but is a cooperatively based society? And what does that imply for the way we work together? A lot of ideas there. The world, the group and the individual. The importance of the balance between individual integrity on the one hand and working together. How can you work together with others? How can you do that thing of together we can change the world without losing track of your own personal development and your own integrity and your own independence of mind, you know. So those are some of them. I didn't actually mention the overall headings, which were some of the essentials, and then Buddhism and the mind, art, beauty and myth in the Buddhist tradition, Buddhism and the heart, and Buddhism and the world.
If we do all of those, we'll probably keep
us going for a long time. Yeah. We may have to be a bit selective and maybe come back to some of those long time. I'm sure we'll come back to it. Does that sound interesting? Could that be interesting?
Yes.
So I'm going to stop there. I know there's a lot more, obviously, to say about it, but if anyone has any questions, we've still got a quarter of an hour, so that would be interesting to hear.